millionaire businessman lost all 10 of his children in a terrible windstorm. Then his business failed, and he was struck down by a painful disease. I'll be back in a moment with the amazing facts about Job's comforters. Hello, this is Joe Cruz and the Amazing Facts broadcast, facts which affect you. The rugged, solitary country of Northwest Arabia is the setting for one of the great epics of ancient literature. In this land of Uz, there were no cities, only occasional tribal villages of desert herdsmen and traders. The conditions of the times are described elsewhere in the Bible, only in the first book of the Bible, Genesis. The hero of the drama, Job, may have been a contemporary of Jacob or Joseph. This locates the original story almost as long before Christ as we are after Christ. Now, Job was renowned for his wisdom. When he spoke, men listened respectfully and received his counsel in silence. After he had spoken on a matter, there was no further argument. He had the last word. He was a man of great power and dignity. When he appeared in the village square, the young men, the Bible says, withdrew, and the aged rose and stood up. The princes refrained from talking. The nobles held their peace. You'll find that in Job 29, 8-10. He was also very rich. He probably owned several tribal villages. His herdsmen tended 7,000 sheep. His ownership of 3,000 camels indicates that he may have been a large carrier of international commerce. With his 500 donkeys, he was able to handle a large share of the local trade as well. His 500 yoke of oxen allowed him to farm on an extended scale. In these various enterprises, he undoubtedly employed a very large number of people. For a man to operate on a comparable level in modern times, he'd have to own a steamship line, a fleet of trucks, or a platoon of tractors, and all the machinery and property that goes with it. The drama introduces its hero by the assertion, quote, that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Job 1, verse 3. Now, Job's standard of living was commensurate with his great wealth. His 7 sons and 3 daughters indulged in a regular schedule of wild parties. As any godly father would, Job worried about his pleasure-loving and wayward children. He would rise early in the morning to remember them before God. During his business trips and vacations, he made friends in many different countries. Several of these came to visit him while he was sick. There was Eliphaz from Teman, a city near the impregnable natural fortress of Petra in South Edom. Bildad, possibly a grandson of Abraham by his second wife Keturah, came from northern Syria. Zophar probably came from the east of the Jordan. Elihu, perhaps a descendant of Abraham's brother Nahor, quite likely lived in northern Mesopotamia. The book opens by taking us behind the scenes of life as we know it and permitting us to listen in on a magnificent celestial council. High on his infinite throne sits the God of the universe, and gathered before him are those of his sons who were present at the creation of this world. It seems that each of these is the representative of an inhabited planet somewhere in space. Among them is Satan, prince of the planet Earth. When it came his turn to report, God asked of him, "Whence have you come?" And Satan answered, "From going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down on it." This is in Job 1, verse 7. Jehovah demanded that Satan be more specific by asking, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Now, Satan did not deny that Job was a good man. However, he questioned his motives. And he said, "Job doesn't serve you out of the goodness of his heart. You surrounded him with all his property and with a hedge so that I can't get to him. You've given him power. You've made him rich. He's well paid indeed for his service. He's in love with his wealth, not with you. Strip him of his property and he'll curse you to your face." Now, friends, there was a strange silence among the other delegates as they waited in embarrassment to see whether the Almighty would reply to this impudence of Satan. But God calmly accepted the challenge, and he answered, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself do not put forth your hand." Well, of course, Job knew nothing about this counsel. He was on earth enjoying business as usual. and his children were throwing a big party. And then suddenly a messenger came running and told Job, the oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them when a band of marauders from the southwest murdered the workmen and stole the animals. And before the man had quite finished his message, another runner arrived to say that a brush fire on the prairie had consumed all the sheep. As this was yet speaking, another servant came rushing in with the information that three companies of Chaldean bandits had raided Job's caravan and gotten away with all his camels. And just as he finished delivering his communique, one of the waiters at the dinner being given at the house of Job's oldest son came running and breathlessly blurted out that a hurricane had swept across the desert, struck the house in which the party was being held, killing every one of Job's children. Well, the hand of Satan had fallen suddenly and heavily. Within the period of a few moments, the great rich sheikh learned that he had become a childless pauper. Overwhelmed and stunned, he numbly rose to his feet, rent his robe, drew his sword to cut the hair from his head, then fell to the ground and worshipped in anguish. "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Job 1:21. The dramatist adds this aside, "In all this, Job did not sin or charge God foolishly." Verse 22. At the next great council in heaven, the Lord asked Satan for a progress report on Job. Had he not maintained his integrity through impoverishment as well as in wealth? Was Satan prepared to admit that a man would serve God without pay? His reply was that Job was the sort of utterly self-centered egotist to whom possessions and even family didn't mean much. However, if his own person should be made to suffer, he would unhesitatingly curse God to his face. So God countered by removing more of the protecting hedge around Job. "Behold," he said, "he's in your power. Only spare his life." So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And this affliction was called by the ancients black leprosy, a revolting, deadly disease that, to their minds, indicated a direct stroke of God, which could be provoked only by the most heinous of sins. Job now became not only a pauper, but also a social outcast. He moved from his house to the city dump, where he sat on the ash heap and scraped his festering sores with bits of broken pottery. Even his wife urged him to curse God and commit suicide. The news of Job's degradation spread rapidly abroad, and his friends Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu made the long, tedious journey to extend their condolences and comfort. However, when they arrived, they were shocked, speechless. Things were much worse than they had suspected. How could they sympathize with one so obviously cursed by God? They decided to play it safe and not say anything. For 7 whole days they camped at the dump without saying a word to their friend. And during this time, Job took inventory of his position. His possessions were gone. His children were dead. He was driven from the society of mankind. His wife had turned against him. His friends were speechless in their abhorrence of him. And even he could not help despising his own rotting body. Why should he live? Indeed, why had he been born? Finally, he broke the silence with a cry bespeaking his wish that the moment of his birth could be blotted out of time. He would have God forget the day. He would have the night of his conception blanked out of the calendar. Bitterly, he wailed, "Why was I not stillborn? Why couldn't I have starved in infancy? Then I would have lain down in permanent sleep and would not be at rest, and would now be at rest." His despair was so profound that he not only felt it preferable to die than to live any longer, but he even regretted living at all if it must end in this way. Finally, after a week of silence, Eliphaz spoke up. Although he had come to sympathize, what he had to say was of little comfort. He declared that such tragedies as had befallen Job could not result from right living. A person simply reaps what he's sown. Obviously, Job had not sown in righteousness. In addition, this friend claimed to have had a vision in which it was revealed to him that man is essentially evil and therefore subject to the wrath of God. He advised Job to mend his ways and to seek forgiveness from God for his terrible sins if he ever expected to be restored. Then Bildad ventured to add his counsel. He claimed that God had sent the hurricane against Job's children to punish them for their sins. He assured the sick man that if he was upright and pure, his prayers would have been answered by now. He insisted that in this world there is sure suffering for the wicked and equally sure happiness for the righteous. Job ought not to cover his evil past any longer. His suffering was undeniable evidence that he must have been a great sinner through the years of that supposed piety. Zophar was even more severe than the others. He bluntly told Job that his punishment was probably less than he deserved. He denounced as presumptuous his efforts to learn the ways of God. All three companions agreed that affliction comes as a direct judgment for sin and that prosperity results as a reward for pleasing God. They were actually echoing the philosophy expressed by Satan when he charged God with buying the allegiance of Job. His friends had urged him to confess his sins, but he was too honest to confess sins that he had never committed. Because of his inability to enter the dwelling place of God, and in the absence of a mediator between himself and God, there was but one course left for him. He would summon God from his abode in the heavens to the ash heap on which he sat, and there he would defend his case himself before the God whose ways he obviously did not understand. He feared this to be a dangerous procedure. However, his faith in God's justice was greater than his fear of God's wrath. Some people's faith is aroused only by fear. They pray only when they're alarmed. Such are weaklings, of course, midgets of faith. But from the abyss of despair, from the pit of his fear, Job, a giant of faith, arose to affirm, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Hear diligently my speech. I've ordered my cause. I know that I shall be justified." Job 13:15-18. It's a rare thing to find faith in God that's so entirely dependent on one's personal welfare. With most people, faith fluctuates in proportion to how well they feel that God lines up with their personal plans. Such faith, of course, is not in God at all, but in oneself. When Job exercised his faith, it grew. From where he was sitting, he could see the stump of a fallen tree. The tree was dead. The stump was rotting. Then he noticed that from the stump, a sapling had sprouted. He knew that although the stump would completely decay, from the new shoot would grow a new tree. Could this be a parable of human life? Could it be that not all the rewards and punishments of man are received before death? He ventured to ask the question that was heavy on his heart. If a man die, shall he live again? Chapter 14:14. Was it possible that a new life would spring forth after his dying body had returned to the dust? A question asked in such absolute faith did not go unanswered. Quick as a flash, there came to Job the answer. As a fallen tree, so he would die. As a decaying stump, so his body would return to dust. And as a sapling brought forth new life out of death, so also new life would be his again. In joyous confidence, he cried out to the God whom he recognized as giving him this assurance, "Thou shalt call, and I will answer thee." Thus, with both of his original doubts removed, Job ascended the pinnacle of faith and understanding.